All right, we are plugged in and ready to rock and roll. It's Monday, the 24th of May here in Sydney, Australia. You're listening to the Kraz Files podcast with Adam, and researcher Tracy Northern is plugging in with me again tonight to continue our podcast shows, which have just done so well and been so popular. So really good to be able to do these kinds of shows, and we're doing a third installment tonight, if you will. So we have done a great two previous shows we've done already, and they have been received so well, and so many great comments and people sharing them, so it's been awesome. The first one we did was an Idiot's Guide to Germ Theory, and then the second one we did was on Contagion, fact-checked. And so tonight, Tracy, am I right in saying that we're going to look at isolation of these so-called viruses? Is that where you're going to go tonight?
Well, we're actually going to be looking at the invention of the virus.
The invention. It's
I'm calling it viruses, the never-ending story.
Well, it's worth doing, and I know you're going to cover all of this tonight. It's going to be a really great show, and you've got a great presentation for us, and I think that this is really important, and it's been really crazy times. I've just had Tracy some friends who are going and getting Pfizer jabs and all of this. And people that I know or grew up with, and I'm just shaking my head, you know, and I've tried to stop some, but I can't. And so that's their life. And they're basically, you know, they're walking blindfolded into needles, really, based on what they're hearing on the media and from the government and all this propaganda. And I'm just sitting here thinking, wow, you know, how can you go and get one of these experimental injections shoved into your body and you don't know anything about it and you've asked no questions? And, you know, it's incredible times, and I do feel like I'm in an old black and white episode of The Twilight Zone, you know, and I'm stuck there. I can't get out, you know. So I think tonight's show, you're going to cover some really important critical points here for our listeners. And as I said before, these shows have done so great on the new BitChute channel, which I've revamped. And so hi to all you guys over there. Thanks so much for all the comments and sharing the show and getting involved. It's really cool. Everything's up on my website, krazfiles.com, and you can contact me through there and get involved over there. I put a lot of stuff up, so you know, plenty to go over, and thanks to my members as well. You help me to continue here, and you can support me through membership for a cup of coffee a month over on krazfiles.com, and it just helps me to move forward. So Tracy, amazing times, and great to have you on again. I know you've done a lot of work on this particular piece tonight, and it's going to be a bit deeper, but it's really important that we get this information out, and seeing how well the other podcasts have been received, this is fantastic to be able to do this. And so you haven't given me any material on what you're going to cover or anything. I'm just going to be plugged out here and taking notes myself and listening in, as you always do. You do presentations, I will. If you're ready to move forward with tonight's show, that would be great, and you can bring it in anytime you choose. And thanks so much for all your great, fantastic research and efforts and doing these shows. They've really been amazing and eye opening, and I myself have learned so much as well, as others have. So great work.
Awesome. Thank you. Okay. I touched on the invention of the virus in the Germ Theory and Idiot's Guide. I didn't go into detail yet. So now that you've hopefully absorbed that the germ theory is wrong and contagion is also a myth, Adam thought it might be time to delve into the virus theory, how it came about and why, and to break down the wall of pseudoscience that they've built up around it. And the story of how viruses came about, it seems really complicated and sciencey, and that's on purpose. It's a bit like how they wrote the Bible originally in Latin, so the common people couldn't read it for themselves, but had to rely on priests to deliver the message, using their own agenda and their interpretations. And now they're using Latin again, in biological science to keep us in the dark. So we have to listen to the new priests in this new cult, the doctors. There are scientists speaking out, but they're still using this own language, which can be daunting. So I'll try and keep it as simple as I can, and hopefully interesting. Once you get a look behind the curtain and see what's really been going on, you won't fall for the dramatic nonsense most of the big talkers and controlled opposition are pushing. Only yesterday I read a post all about the Fauci case before Congress, where Rand Paul questioned Fauci on his funding of something they call gain of function. This talk will hopefully show you what that actually means and why all this talk of bioweapons is not something to freak out about per se, but more of a thing to keep an eye on. Because what they've done and what they're doing is much more ludicrous than the conspiracists are saying. So to start with, let's look at the beginnings, where it all started. As I said, the germ theory was teetering on very shaky foundations right from the start. But with no internet back then, it was easy to promote an idea and hush dissenters, which were the scientists themselves and physicians. From Bichamp to Reif and many doctors in between, even Florence Nightingale, they were all saying that germ theory couldn't work and proving it. So something had to be concocted using their circular reasoning to shut them up. Something that no one could see to keep us in the dark. The word virus, pre-1930, was already being referred to as a poisonous liquid. Something no one could see under a microscope. And something that passed through the finest filter. Hence they called it a filterable virus or poison. Even today, they claim Beijer Inc. discovered the first virus. Yet what he actually discovered was, again, that germs were not the cause. So it had to be something else. And he used the word virus in the old meaning of poison. They leave out the bit about the meaning of that word at the time, though. They show pictures of this tobacco mosaic virus to this day, despite it not even looking like a virus and being far too big. The pictures are in fact just pictures of a type of plant cell called a xylem cell, which moves water and nutrients up and down the stem of the plant. So the picture is a fraud. How many plant scientists though link this to human biology and recognise it's not a virus because they've been compartmentalised? I spotted it straight away when I was shown it on a plant science course. But then I'm not stuck in one ology box. if you check Wikipedia's history of the virus, they're claiming that many people discovered viruses before 1931, which can't be true because that was before the invention of the electron microscope. So there was actually no proof of their claims. The only thing they were proving was it wasn't bacteria causing the disease they were studying. These discoveries were all the results of taking samples of pus or sputum from sick people, filtering it, and voila, they've discovered a new virus. Nothing to see here. Also, none of Koch's postulates were fulfilled in any of these new virus discoveries. They just seemed to have thrown those out the window again. They were even making vaccines from this gunk for years, just soldiering on like the blind leading the blind. Or was it fraud? They kept using this crude blind method to claim discovery of many supposed viruses, including the ones they claimed were causing cancers, like the SV40 everyone raves about. No isolation was ever done, just vials of ingredients from tumours being called viruses. Strange, though, that cancer's not contagious, yet viruses are. Anyone notice that glaring error in their story? So, going back briefly to 1858, Rudolf Virchow wrote his cell theory, which said that the cell was the smallest unit of life and that the cell could produce poisons, which they called virus back then, and that this poisonous liquid produced disease. So saying it was the smallest unit in biology is not true. It was just a hypothesis, an idea, which was never verified in science. So Bergerinck's discovery of the tobacco mosaic virus was based on this theory, and his use of the word virus meant poison. So he believed the poison was coming from the cells, just like viruses today are said to do. So this virus theory, the poison produced by the cells, was generally agreed on until the 1920s to 30s. Then, after taking over the medical colleges by the Rockefellers and their new registration system, which made only medicine based on germ theory available, they also changed the definition of the word virus in the medical dictionaries, followed by the general dictionaries. In 1935, Wendell Stanley, using a new microscope called an electron microscope, re-examined the tobacco mosaic virus and found it was mostly made of protein. In 1939, Stanley again and Max Laufer separated the virus into protein and DNA, or RNA, but that's another story. Just think genetic material. This becomes important later. So now, mixing all this together, cell theory, germ theory, and what they saw under the new microscope, instead of viruses being a poison liquid produced in the cells, it was changed to a pathogenic microbe, too small to see with a microscope, consisting of genetic material wrapped in protein, which could invade, like germs supposedly did, and attack you from the outside. This despite never seeing anything attack or invade, because electron microscopes can only look at dead stuff in a vacuum. Nothing living or moving. DNA is not living or a microbe. Did you know that the double helix, they say is what DNA looks like, was based on a woman's X-ray photograph called Picture 51? Just like Area 51, her discovery was kept quiet. Rosalind Franklin worked out, using this picture, chemistry reasoning and mathematics, the famous double helix, which is being challenged now, so probably also wrong. So no one's seen this DNA structure. It's all imagined, again. DNA is said to be chemicals in crystal form, definitely not alive. The protein's also not living on its own, as it's just a building block. It's the stuff everything living is made from, like a piece of Lego, which on its own can't be something living, but put together with lots of other building blocks, it becomes something. Like chemicals and minerals are made up of atoms, living things are made up of proteins. Although proteins are also made up of atoms, but you get my drift. Rivers was the first to use the term obligate parasite to describe viruses. Where did that come from? But parasites are living things, and these viruses were not. They were simply particles. But calling them parasites helped their circular reasoning of these particles needing a living cell to replicate, in other words, our cells. None of this was based on science. It was purely political word salad. How can crystals and building blocks suddenly become a parasite that can make baby parasites? Ridiculous. But everyone bought it because science. This new convoluted version of the virus held until 1951, when some German scientists decided to do some control experiments. This is basically like a placebo where nothing's changed or added to see if the same thing happens as in the experiment with the alleged virus or poisons. So healthy tissues were left alone to rot naturally beside the healthy tissue damaged by the supposed virus. Both tissues, virus-infected tissues and non-infected, produced the exact same proteins, no difference. That should have been the end of that theory. But instead they buried the experiments in specialist journals where no one but other scientists would see them or understand their significance. Max Planck's Institutes für Wissenschaft Geschichte did these experiments in Germany. At the same time, the newly invented electron microscope could find no difference between the infected and the non-infected tissues, which they still haven't seen to this day. So far, they'd based virus theory on cell theory and germ theory, but they were slowly mixing in a new ingredient to their super theories, from studying bacteriophages. These are a type of spore that bacteria make when their living conditions become hostile by acidity, poisons, toxemia, or a lack of oxygen. They like these phages because it fitted with their original cells producing poisons theory. It fitted perfectly. But one problem, the spores were not harmful. And it turns out they're actually the microzyma that Bichamp spoke of in his work, and Nason's also discovered and named somatids. They seem to be the very basis of all life, a kind of multi-seed similar to a stem cell, but for microbes. This is why we often hear those news stories about viruses being the basis of all life and being found in ancient ice cores, yet they can still come alive after all these years like a dormant seed. This is the somatid, or the microzyma, that we spoke of in the germ theory talk, the same ones from the pleomorphism theory. Has anyone else put these two things together and realised they're the same thing? The description of these spores is some genetic material wrapped in protein. But that's not what their CGI pictures look like. They've made them look like nanobots, funnily enough, and not like the CGI pictures of viruses at all. Probably so no one would link the two together like I just have. Without any evidence, they claim that phages attack the bacteria, rape them, impregnate their DNA, so causing the bacteria to die. But the story doesn't fit the evidence again. Only bacteria that are extremely inbred, meaning reproducing without any contact with other bacteria or microbes, turn into phages by metamorphosis. This process of morphing was being interpreted as the phages killing the bacteria, but it was simply pleomorphism. The bacteria can change forms when threatened. Bacteria that are freshly plucked from their environment never change into phages. They also don't die if phages are added to them. Each species of phage always carries the same unique DNA, which is the basis of their virus theory too, except that they just can't make that stick either, because despite the advances in genetic science, they hit a wall again. No one could isolate DNA or RNA from any tissue or bodily fluid and show it to be the right length and composition as a virus should be by their reckoning. On June 1st, 1954, along came the next first big discovery of a virus, published by Professor John Franklin Enders, which gave us the theory that cells which die in the test tube after adding supposedly infected material, turn into viruses. Cell theory again, but now mixed with the phage theory. This method would go on to be the standard method of growing viruses in the lab. This death of cells was and still is called isolation of the virus, even though no isolation takes place in any meaning of the word. In their mad excitement, everyone ignored the obvious, that the death of the cells in the lab was not caused by a virus, but by poisoning with antibiotics, extreme starvation by withdrawing all nutrients, and by adding decomposing enzymes. And this mixture of all these noxious things is what they use to inject into our children and call vaccines. Lanker said if this soup was directly shot into a vein, it would cause instant death. That wouldn't be good for business, though. Debris from the cells that die in the lab are still to this day used as pictures of viruses and presented as such in scientific papers. The science of virology is that simple. A bit too simple, maybe, So just to add more confusion and to further bury those pesky control experiments, they came up with the brilliant plan of merging virology with genetics. Genetics was the new big thing with loads of lovely funding money and viral theory being on shallow foundations, just like germ theory. It was another purely political financial move. So suddenly viruses were no longer a viral protein anymore, but a dangerous gene sequence called a viral genome. They thought they discovered how viruses inject their DNA with something called reverse transcriptase. So if they detected this process, it meant there was what they called a retrovirus present. The story just keeps getting more convoluted. This was their new cover story to explain how dead particles replicate or zombies have babies. It's not the virus doing it, it's an enzyme. Reverse transcriptase is what the RT in front of PCR refers to on the PCR tests. You see how this is coming together nicely. So what's an enzyme? It's a protein which acts as a chemical catalyst. What's a catalyst? It's a chemistry term. It's a substance that initiates or accelerates a chemical reaction. So if we break this all down into plain English, they found an enzyme which breaks tissues and cells down, like decomposing them, and they claim it's proof there is a virus around doing it. But we can't see it, so let's pretend chemistry can see it. Just to touch on antibodies here, as we're talking about enzymes, antibodies are also just enzymes, which are said to be involved in blood clotting. It would make sense to also assume they are around when cells die and to assist in the decomposing process, probably of those bits of broken DNA. They do not fight viruses or germs at all, and the whole immune system story is also made up nonsense. This RT is said to happen because of a retrovirus. Apparently it's retro because it works backwards. Instead of injecting DNA, it injects RNA into the host cell, which makes the DNA make more RNA. But hang on, if RNA is only half a strand of DNA, it could be just broken DNA from the decomposing process, right? So this is how they solved that pesky problem of not being able to find the whole viral DNA before. They just changed the story again. There's little proof that anything they've told us about DNA is even true. It's very likely early virus theory, very, very like early virus theory, with no visual proof of its existence or functions. So just like the pathogen got smaller and smaller as microscopes got better, no one can now see what is supposedly causing disease again. We've just gone round in another circle. I didn't want to get into DNA or retroviruses exactly because it is one of their circular arguments which sends you round and round on a never-ending chase for something to make sense. After you've been around the block a couple of times, you realise you always end up back where you started though. They haven't isolated any virus yet, so how can any of this be based on facts, let alone science? It's all just convoluted stories, laying a false trail of crumbs to keep you and I busy and not looking at the whole picture. You can get totally lost in the details. This is exactly why they've merged biology with technology, to keep us continually in the dark. So, onwards. In 1983, RT-PCR was invented within genetics research, but it quickly pegged as the new wonder tool to spot retroviruses, because remember, they've merged now. This virus test that is used is a genetic test. The genetic sequences the test seeks were never isolated from any virus, as I've explained. It picks up typical bits of genetic sequences, which are released in increasing quantities when tissues and cells die. These short genetic sequences are component parts of the human metabolism. In other words, it's bits of your own DNA. It picks up fragments, not whole strands. So they fill in the gaps with computer modelling, fill them in with whatever they choose. It's a bit like trying to do a jigsaw with missing pieces. So you take some bits out of another jigsaw puzzle with missing pieces and use those bits to try and make it look like the picture on the box. Unknown or novel gene sequences or viruses can't be found with a PCR test. First, the isolation and sequencing of a virus has to be done to develop a PCR test for it, which has to come from the virus, which they've never isolated. Round and round it goes. This wonderful new gene lab tool became the virus industry's greatest marketing ploy. Now they could tell anyone they were infected with their own DNA. It also became the tool they used to claim a virus isolation. Since its invention, all papers claiming isolation of a new virus are done only using PCR and gene sequencing, cutting out all the problematic lab work which never found any viruses. It also resurrected the original reason the germ theory failed, as a reason viruses do not, namely asymptomatic carriers. Like Typhoid Mary, we're all sick, we just don't know it, and everyone can be a serial killer. I'm gobsmacked that people even buy this crap. When they found germs in healthy people that were meant to be making them sick, it threw germ theory out the window, which was why they invented the virus. Yet now the same theme is being played out again. So they took the opposite theory, the terrain theory and pleomorphism, and slapped it on top, and bingo, they have viruses morphing and laying dormant like phages and bacteria again. Checkmate. Nor was it. It seems their plans for medical world domination hit another hurdle in 2016 when Stefan Lanka challenged the world's virologists to produce the proof of one virus. His public challenge went like this. The sum of €100,000 will be paid on presentation of a scientific publication in which the existence of the measles virus is not only claimed but actually proven, and in which the diameter of the virus is determined. Many have heard of this case, which should have shattered the whole industry, except they only printed half the story in the press, the half they liked. The story the world was told was that Lanka lost the bet when Biden's offered up six papers, the first of which was the Enders paper we already touched on earlier. The other five were just props to try and fill in the missing bits from the first paper, which didn't prove any viruses were found. Of course, judges can't understand the scientific papers any better than most of us can. So the papers were accepted on face value, so the matter had to go back to court over the non-payment of the prize money. By appealing the decision, Lanka got to explain the meaning of those papers and demonstrate the fraud and the false claim, thereby winning the case at the appeal. There was no control experiment in any of the papers. Lanka also paid an independent lab to perform the control experiments 60 years later and presented the results to the court. This second part of the story was totally ignored by the press. The scientists and skeptics all ganged up on the story, claiming sour grapes and details were poured over, but it still stands that the measles virus was not proven to exist. As I always like to point out, why would they find it so difficult to produce the proof of a virus that they've been supposedly pumping into millions of kids since the 50s? It technically should be a walk in the park. This second appeal case quietly happened in 2017. And I'd been doing my own research and often used a website called the Picture Book of Viruses. And I noticed in 2017 that the picture of the measles virus was taken down and the letters NA left in their place, not applicable. Amazing. I'm glad I got a screenshot of it before they rearranged the whole site. Someone was obviously taking the verdict more seriously than they wanted to admit. Now all the fake pics are under Latin names again, so none of you will bother looking at their fakery. It's only for the initiated cult members now. Legally, they now could be done for fraud because of that court case. Here's what was said about it by the clerk of the court. The highest court confirmed judgment in the measles virus trial has removed the basis of the whole of virology. Not only that, it has been established in case law now that the method used since 1954 to prove the viruses exist is no longer valid in 2016 and beyond. This one case should have been the end of the vaccine industry too. Do you think this might have made them need to change the face of vaccines again? I think so. It must have. Since this case, it seems like the science of virology has gone into overdrive in pushing the fear factor of their unproven and now challenged virus theory, using their usual tack of Latin word salads. For a while, they stopped using the word virus and changed to proteins and phages and even prions. I noticed this change, but many didn't. But now suddenly they've come back with a vengeance. Reminds me of a boxer after a bad round coming out all guns blazing. To try and hide their bruises, they've plumped for total obfuscation, wrapped up in computer modelling, mathematics and playing with gene fragments, like a Meccano set trying to manually build their fantasy virus genome into reality. This is where the gain of function comes in that I mentioned at the start. So what is gain of function? Basically, it's taking something harmless, which they'd plumped to play the part of a virus, the microzyme perhaps, or maybe some protein, and trying to make it do what they've always told us a virus does. They're trying to make it act the part of the villain. They're actually trying to make Pinocchio into a real boy in real life. This is the bioweapon that all the truthers are shouting about. But the mistake that everyone's making is thinking they can do it, when in reality they haven't even passed the first hurdle yet. They haven't even proved their viruses are real. They're not trying to make a dangerous super virus bioweapon. They're actually just trying to make one virus. Because in reality, they haven't found one yet. It's even in plain sight, with their protein spikes taking the place of a virus now. Can't you see how they're muddying the waters? The PCR tests were a boon for finding any gene sequence they want in anyone they want. So making potentially the whole world infected, so looking like a contagious disease. And that's exactly what they did. What these tests are actually picking up is bits of our own microbiomes, DNA fragments, also from our own bacteria. Remember those phages? Bacteria have much more DNA than our own cells, so these so-called variants and mutations could keep going forever, unless we all know the game they're playing. Also, it's now well known that our DNA does change. It's not fixed at all. Epigenetics is well known now, thanks to Bruce Lipton. This is how Lanka explains these mutations. Here comes a bit of science. Sequence alignment is a bioinformatics technique in which fragments of nucleic acid, DNA, are assembled with a computer into a hypothetical strand of genetic material. In order to carry out the alignment, roughly comparable to a jigsaw puzzle, templates in the form of old strands of genetic material are required, in the same way as the picture on the box of a puzzle serves as a template. In the case of SARS-CoV-2, two old corona models were used for this purpose. Because during the alignment process, large parts of the constructed genome strand are freely invented and other parts are tweaked by the associated computer programs to produce a reasonably credible result. The finished product never looks 100% like the template. It's similar to forcibly putting together puzzle pieces that don't even belong to the original to create a similar image. So, voila, new variant. To bring you up to date with this whole COVID thing and the bat story and the escaped from a lab secret bioweapon thing, can you work out what went on now from what I've told you in plain English? No, they hadn't managed to make a virus, but they did need something quick to cover up for all the vaccine deaths happening in Wuhan. So they coddled together an in silico virus. This is a made up by a computer virus. They took some of their SARS sequences, added some extra bits lumped together from the gene bank where they've been storing all their genetic sequences, and claimed that was the novel virus genome. Truthers found out about the gene sequences being already on the gene bank, with patents too. The Chinese were working on several SARS-CoV vaccines and have lodged three SARS-CoV genetic sequences with the online gene bank. They are named SARS-CoV 1, 2 and 3. All the genetic sequences were manufactured using CRISPR, which means they take bits of genes from animals and humans and splice them together. Remember, you can't patent anything from nature, hence the sequences used were put together by men's hands, or rather by computers. And so the conspiracy theorists put two and two together to make five. A big Chinese conspiracy, which only added more fuel to the fire, creating even more fear of viruses. Those truthers shouting about deadly bioweapons and deflecting the argument to who did it only served to boost the sales of the COVID vaccines, which actually were not brand new at all. The fact that we are being told the fact vaccines for COVID were rushed through is a lie. They've been working on them for almost 20 years with no success. This was probably a human trial gone wrong of these SARS vaccines, which has exploded into a worldwide trial for a totally new genetic modification of our genes, which they're calling vaccines. That's fraud. They've been working on this gene therapy since the 90s. Did they see an opportunity to silently dismantle the struggling vaccine industry and replace it with gene therapy? They've always complained vaccines were not a big profit maker in themselves, mostly because of the time it takes to make them and put them through the testing procedures, which takes years, but also the lack of virus proof and the anti-vax movement. Vaccines were not working and the cat was almost fully out of the bag. So why carry on flogging a dead horse when big tech can come in and save the day and resurrect the dead horse into something more lucrative? What could possibly go wrong? Speaking of resurrecting, how about this? In 1840, inoculation was banned because it was causing smallpox. Remember what I said in my last talk about inoculation spreading across Europe, seeming to cause plagues? That's when Jenner came along and did a little name swap, renaming inoculation to vaccination, even though it's still basically the same process. Jenner was no physician. In fact, in his day, he would have been called a quack. He bought his doctorate papers. Jenner was a Freemason as well. You may think the timeline doesn't fit this name swap, as the ban came out after his new invention. Not new or invented, unless you know how long these new laws take to be implemented. Freemasons are always in the thick of politics and medicine. So was this a preempting of the coming ban? It looks like it to me. It looks like more political dirty dealing for big profits. So, always use Occam's razor when dealing with their stories, meaning always look for the simplest explanation because the truth is always simple. Lies are convoluted and go around in circles, hence the mutations and variants and the ever-changing story of what viruses are. So rather than fearing these mad scientists, we should be locking them up. They really are deluded. Instead of laughing at conspiracy nuts who shout no virus isolation, go and see if what I've said here is true. Look at the methods used. They're always what I've told you here. Read Stefan Lanka's papers, which are challenging not only the whole of virology, but the whole medical system too. His latest challenge is out there now. It's called Project Emmanuel. He's challenged the world's virologists to do the control experiments never done since 1951 for COVID-19. He's already done them himself. It's now up to the rest of them to put up or shut up. If viruses were real, they should have no problem with this. The problem is, though, is anyone going to listen? Remember, the same people own the media, that own medicine and big celebrities and top politicians. You'll not hear anything about this from any of them. Like Carlin said, it's one big club and you ain't in it.